You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Tomorrow, early, I will be hopping on a plane to Seattle and to give a keynote talk at the Yes Magazine 4th Annual Celebration, titled Money, Politics, and Saving Our Democracy in Seattle. And if you're in Seattle, you can get over to yesmagazine.org and sign up for it if you want to show up and say hi and hear what I have to say, and a whole bunch of other good people. But as a consequence of that, I will not be here. Danielle and Shane will be doing this show, so we will have a live show, and they're great hosts. And Senator Sanders is here with us today. Thank TGIT, I guess, for Thursday for Bernie. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you for showing up with us a day early, sir. I really appreciate it. Your take on what's going on in D.C. right now?
Well, there's a lot that's going on. And clearly, there's a lot of focus on ISIS. And there's a lot of focus on a piece of legislation right now on the floor dealing with this disastrous Supreme Court Citizens United decision. So let me just say a word about ISIS and one of the points that I've been making lately. Look, there is no doubt that ISIS is a brutal and very dangerous organization that has already taken over large swaths of land in Iraq and Syria. And that they have got to be opposed. It is my very strong view that the United States cannot do this alone, must not do it alone, that we have got to learn the lesson, painful lesson, of the Bush-Cheney wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that for a start there needs to be an international coalition involved. And second of all, at the end of the day, it will be the people of Iraq and Syria who will ultimately make the decisions. I think it is appropriate for the United States to train moderate forces in Syria, and I think it is appropriate for the president, along with an international coalition, to be involved in airstrikes. But I am adamantly opposed to the United States sending combat ground troops into action. We have been at war now for 12 years and have significantly ignored the enormous problems facing working families in this country. And one of my concerns, Tom, and it has a lot to do with media and the nature of Congress, is that it, at a time when we have a collapsing middle class and more people living in poverty than any time in the history of this country, when real unemployment is 12%, youth unemployment is 20%, when 40 million people still have no health insurance in this country, and we have more income and wealth inequality than any other country on earth, and that situation is getting worse, it is so easy to take our focus off of the problems facing working families. Because, frankly, here in Washington, D.C., you have so many folks who are elected who really take their orders from the billionaire class, from their campaign contributors, and really don't have much allegiance to the working families of this country. It's very easy to forget those issues. Oh, my goodness, we have a crisis in the Middle East again, and we got to prepare for war and all that stuff. Well, I think ISIS is a serious issue, and I think we do have to address it. But what I worry very, very much is that we're going to lose focus on the very, very pressing issues facing so many of our people. It's hard to keep focus under the best of circumstances, but now with all this talk about war and so forth, we can lose that focus. So to my mind, we have got to continue to fight for a major jobs program in this country to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. I know it's not as sexy as fighting ISIS, but it could put millions of people back to work who desperately need work, pretty important to working families in this country. We've got to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. You and I, for years, and we're some of the few who talk about our disastrous trade policies, which have enabled companies to shut down in America, move to China, tax policies which have enabled companies in America to try to leave the United States to go elsewhere to save some money on their taxes. We have got to deal with the planetary crisis of global warming and all of the devastation that is causing today and will increasingly cause in years to come. So there are so many important issues out there. But because we live in a nation where billionaires are able to buy elections and able to determine what the issues are, it is very easy to ignore the issues facing American working people. There's an election coming up, and I think everybody knows that I'm going to do everything that I can to prevent the Republicans from taking over the Senate, and there's about a 50-50 chance that will happen. But what we understand to be the case from pundits, and I think it's probably true, is that unless things change in the next couple of months, 60% of the American people are not going to vote in this election. 60%. And that means 70 to 80% of low-income working people. So the people who will benefit from a raise in the minimum wage, 70, 80% of those people are not going to vote. I was in South Carolina a couple of weeks ago, talking to somebody there who was working, trying to organize fast food workers. And she said, well, we did some calculations. We're working with about 500 workers. 15 of them are registered to vote. Whoa. So how do you change what goes on in America if billionaires are able to put unlimited sums of money into campaigns? The Koch brothers have already, as we understand it, already in this election cycle, bought 44,000 ads. And they got 2 months left to go. So you and I have, and the average American has one vote, and the Koch brothers have one vote, except they can spend hundreds of millions of dollars to buy elections. Meanwhile, the media pays very little attention to who the Koch brothers are, what they stand for, their goals in terms of eliminating Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, eliminating the concept of the minimum wage, and so forth. So, bottom line is we have got to stay focused on the needs of ordinary Americans while we work with an international coalition to address the crisis in the Middle East.
Agreed. We have about 2 minutes, I think, left. Anything else?
There is a lot else that's going on. And we have, you know, as I have stated many times, Tom, I think that the major, that the deepest issue, you know, there are 100 issues out there. When one of the things you learn as a United States senator is everybody has an issue. And you know what? Those issues are important to everybody. But at the end of the day, if you were to ask me in this country what the fundamental issue is, the real issue to my mind, most important issue, is whether or not this country moves in the direction of becoming an oligarchic form of society, or whether or not we expand the middle class, and whether we have whether or not we strengthen our democratic foundation so that one person, one vote is the dominant political force in this country. And what I mean by that is right now, in terms of distribution of wealth, you have a situation where the top 1% owns 37% of the wealth, the bottom 60% own 1.7%. So you have an unbelievably obscene, immoral distribution of wealth. And then that translates to politics, because this top 1% is then spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to buy candidates who will support their agenda to make the rich even richer. So distribution of wealth becomes a political issue, and it's also, of course, an economic issue. That is the issue that we need to address.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us a day early. It's Thursday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We're doing our Brunch with Bernie Hour now so that you can call in and ask your questions of Senator Sanders in this national town hall meeting. We'll be right back with your calls for Senator Sanders in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, and you can also easily track him down over on Facebook and on Twitter. And welcome back. Rick in McHenry, Maryland, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish TV satellite network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I got to listen to your position on the ISIS problem we currently have on C-SPAN this morning. And it followed every liberal that I've been watching and listening to for the past few weeks on this subject, that in Ukraine, and it really wanted to make me tear my hair out when I heard you come up with the same rhetoric that these other liberals have. Let's continue to go to war. Let's continue to drop bombs on people. Let's continue to spend our hard-earned money in a place where we don't belong. I'm ashamed of you.
Okay. Well, Rick, let me respond to that. And thank you for your comments, and I appreciate it. I opposed the war in Iraq. And, in fact, I opposed the very first Gulf War. I'm not a great fan of war, so I don't want you to characterize me as a great fan of war. But when you say, you know, there are places in the world where we don't, should not be involved, well, I don't know. If you have folks who are incredibly brutal, who are currently killing people right and left who do not agree with them, who certainly will do everything they can to attack the United States and Europe, who now have perhaps, if not stopped, the capacity of taking over Iraq and maybe Syria, and to say, well, there's nothing that we can or should do about it. Now, my view is, as somebody who fought as hard as I could against the Bush-Cheney war in Iraq, that, A, I don't want ground troops going into that morass, and I fear very much what some people want is literally perpetual war, where our kids and grandchildren are going to be there forever. But, Rick, all that I would say to you, I really do appreciate where you're coming from, but I got to say that I think the issue is a little bit more complicated, and to say that we should do nothing, I don't think that that is sensible policy. So I believe that it cannot be the United States alone, that it must be an international coalition, that the ground fighting has got to be done by Iraqis and Syrians themselves. But do I support airstrikes, which have already played a pretty good role? Yeah, I do. Do I support the United States helping to train some of the moderate forces in Syria? I do. So I appreciate where you're coming from, Rick. I really do. But I think sometimes in this world, you simply cannot turn your backs on what's going on.
We have 25 seconds, Senator, to the break.
Well, let me just pick up on Rick's point, because, you know, it's a heartfelt position, and others feel that way. The danger, and kind of what I tried to suggest earlier in the program, is there are some people in Congress, and it certainly is not me, who see war as part of what we do. You know, there are kids who are 12 years old today who have never known anything but war in this country. And there are some who want to continue that indefinitely. That is most certainly not my position.
We'll be back with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your questions in Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Sanders with us in our Brunch with Bernie hour a day early. It's Thursday, and Senator Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls, answering your questions. Ray in Van Buren, Arkansas, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. Senator Sanders, I have two quick comments and then a question to ask you. First of all, I'm not ashamed of you. I believe that you are a fantastic senator and that you are providing a viable third option rather than the old, tired, and worn-out boots-on-the-ground Cheney program, or just doing nothing. What we see right now is Rachel Maddow has on her website a rolling list of people in Congress who are saying that it is Congress's duty to vote on this situation with ISIS, and only 30 Republicans are doing this. And I believe Republicans are trying to hide on this issue right now because they want to pull the classic bait and switch and argue against whatever Obama proposes rather than actually signing their name on the dotted line and actually voting for what they want and putting it out there for all Americans to see. Now, my question is this. Since there's only around 30 Republicans who have either publicly said or have sent a letter to President Obama saying that it is Congress's duty to vote on this. What do you think is the long-term game and program that the Republicans are up to right now?
Ray, that's an excellent question, and you've raised a number of different issues in your question. And I think one of the Republicans, I can't recall who he was pretty honest.
Yeah, it was the congressman from Georgia who said, if we don't do anything, if it goes badly, we can blame Obama, and if it goes well, we can say, why didn't you do it sooner?
Right, and I think that was Ray's question, and, yeah. I think that's clearly a lot of what has to happen. And the other question is, people say, well, you know, Congress should get involved, which obviously it should. But doing what? Doing what? Are there Republicans who... You know, one of the things I got to say, you know, is that Obama has been criticized, you know, one of his statements that we don't have a strategy yet on ISIS, you know, it was, you know, reprinted a million times in the media. This is an enormously complicated issue. And I think back to the Bush-Cheney days where they were very strong and they were very decisive. The only problem was they were dead wrong and they lied. And they committed the worst foreign policy blunder in the modern history of America. So I think to criticize the president, and there's nobody in the Democratic caucus, by the way, who over the years has not been more critical of Barack Obama than I am. But I think for a number of areas, mostly economic. But to say that this guy is trying to think through this incredibly, unbelievably complicated issue and not do what Bush Cheney did. You know, Rick, the first caller, you know, was concerned. The last thing in the world that we want to do is to have troops involved in a never-ending war. But I think most Americans understand that if you have a fanatical, brutal group like ISIS taking over Iraq or taking over Syria, and I'm not fear-mongering here. I don't know. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. But that would be a disaster and not solve the problem. It would not go away. It would only become worse. How, in the midst of a situation in Syria where you got an awful demagogue named Assad who has used poison gas on his own people, and he's the good guy because ISIS is even worse than him, what do you do? What do you do? When you have a weak Iraqi government, and hopefully we have a better government now, which is more inclusive, what do you do? Do you simply say, we shouldn't be involved? That's it? Well, maybe. That's not a totally crazy concept. I disagree with it, though, because I think it doesn't go away. So to answer Ray's point, we have got to figure out a solution that does not get us into a never-ending war, which gives support to those people who are prepared to fight against ISIS, which makes this not an American effort, but an international effort, which deals with these guys in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, these multi-billionaire authoritarian countries who have made huge amounts of money from oil. Well, you know what? They got to stop putting some money into this as well, and Kuwait as well. So, you know, what the president is trying to do is figure out something that is enormously complicated, not repeat the disasters of the Bush-Cheney era. And, you know, I would rather have somebody being very thoughtful and premeditated on this rather than somebody who commits a terrible, terrible mistake.
Yeah. We have 45 seconds, Senator. John Boehner is on TV right now, presumably criticizing the president. I don't know. What do you see about the politics of this?
Well, look, I think what that fellow from Georgia said is exactly what their politics is. Look, everything is political around here. And if they can portray the president as weak, as indecisive, as responsible for every problem in the world, and there are a whole lot of problems in the world, then that's to their political advantage. And I hope the American people do not forget about how we got into Iraq and how quickly the war in Afghanistan was supposed to end, and we're still there 12 years later. I hope people do not forget the cost of those wars in terms of human life and pain, as well as financial costs.
Thank you. We will be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, a day early here on Thursday on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov, and you can easily track him down using Bernie Sanders on Twitter and Facebook. Taking back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. We're doing our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting a day early, with thanks to the senator for accommodating our schedule. And Randall in Oceanside, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. Last week I called in and asked you a question about high-frequency trading. You didn't really answer the question, but you went off about the six major corporations, that financial corporations, five of which are bigger now than they were when it was when they were too big to fail. My question is this: if you run for president, will you make a plank in your platform to be a trust buster like Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, Randall, thanks very much. You're right. I remember your question, and you're right. I did not definitively answer it, and I said what you just mentioned. I said, I think that not only in Wall Street, when you talk about Wall Street, it's not only that five out of the six large financial institutions are bigger today than they were when we bailed them out. It is they write something like 50% of the mortgages in this country and two-thirds of the credit cards in this country. That is enormous economic power. And in area after area of our economy, you see fewer and fewer large corporations, whether it's agriculture, media, or whatever it may be, controlling what goes on in that sector. So to answer your question, yeah, a trust buster is exactly what we need to create a competitive economics in this country. So the answer to your question is a very, very big yes, and I think you start on Wall Street. We already have legislation in that would break up these large financial institutions.
Brittenville in Lindenville, Vermont. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Thank you for taking my call. My question for you is, since the Bush administration opened the gates of hell by invading Iraq, would you be in favor of prosecuting members of the Bush administration? Because we wouldn't be in this mess to begin with if they hadn't invaded Iraq illegally.
Well, yeah, thanks for the question. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I was one of the leading opponents of the war in Iraq. People in Vermont certainly know that. I feared many of the things that, in fact, ended up happening. And I think the way you pay them back is politically, to be frank with you. And I think what we need to do is to reject the Bush-Cheney ideology in foreign policy and domestic policy. Remember that these guys not only took us to war, but they were fighting for tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, punishing working people. And I think the fundamental way you do that is by defeating that ideology in the coming election.
Robert in Cleveland, Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. It's an honor to talk to both of you. And if you ever run for president, Senator Sanders, you have my support. In the matter of a living wage scale, the big obstacle is that the Republicans and the right wing feel it's too high to give someone a first job. So I was wondering if you thought about a progressive increase in the wage, where, say, a teenager, their first job would be like for $8.50, a college student from like 18 to 24 who needs a little more money, have their wage start out like at $11.50, and for those who stay on past 21, in that job would have a wage like around $15 an hour. What's your opinion on that?
Well, here's what I think, Robert. I think the Republicans are putting out a lot of disinformation, and I'm sorry, I don't have the information in front of me right now. But the truth of the matter is that most of the people who are working for low wage are not kids just getting some pocket change to buy some clothing. These are adults, often adults who have kids, who are stuck in low-wage jobs. I remember I was in South Carolina a couple of weeks ago talking to a woman who has four kids. She's been working, I believe, at McDonald's for a number of years, and she managed to get a wage increase from $7.25 to $7.35 an hour. That is her wage. I was in Detroit last year talking to young people, some of whom had kids. But these were not teenagers. These were working people who needed an income to survive. They couldn't even get 40 hours a week at $7.25. They have to work at two or three separate places. So I reject the idea that these are just kids' jobs. I think the vast majority of the people are working adults who need a living income. What we're trying to do now is at least raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, which would take about 28 million Americans out of poverty. Because it's, you know, that means if you're making $9 an hour, your wages are going to go up. If you make it $10 an hour, your wages are going to go up. So the estimate is about 28 million Americans will be taken out of poverty. Now, why is this a good thing above and beyond improving the wages of those 28 million people? The answer is that if we want to create jobs in America and deal with the unemployment crisis at a time when real unemployment is 12%, you know the best way to do that is to put money into the hands of working people, increase their disposable income. So when we raise the minimum wage, people who have seen that income, they're going to go out and buy stuff. They're going to take buy goods and buy services. And when they do that, they create more jobs. That's why we believe in rebuilding the infrastructure and putting millions of people back to work. Not only good for the economy, good for those people, it creates jobs. So the goal is to put more money into the hands of working people, and one of the important ways to do that is raise the minimum wage.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. Some misguided immigration reform activists are criticizing the president for delaying executive action for a short 5 weeks or so, blaming the president for Republican obstruction of a real solution only rewards the do-nothing Republicans. Would you please explain how laws are changed in this country, and who do you think is to blame for a lack of immigration reform?
Well, Paul, thanks for the question. You know, and I hate to be, you know, I am an independent. I am perhaps the most progressive member of the U.S. Senate, so everybody knows my politics. But I've never run a negative ad in my life, and I don't like to spend my time beating up on people who disagree with me. But I think what is not widely known, and it's not just immigration, is that this is the most do-nothing Congress in the history of the United States of America. And it is not because there are a lack of issues or a lack of desire on many of our parts to pass important legislation. I was very proud as chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee to pass one of the only significant pieces of legislation passed in the last couple of years. We did manage to get Republican support for that. But if you look at all the issues out there, right now it's not just immigration reform, but it is. We passed immigration reform here in the Senate. Has it been taken up in the House? No, it has not. Right now we have the votes. A majority of members of the Senate want to raise the minimum wage. Do we have any Republican support for that? Virtually none. Right now, literally today, on the floor of the Senate, there maybe is the most important issue facing this country, and that is campaign finance reform and the need to overturn Citizens United. We need 67 votes for a constitutional amendment. Do we have any Republican support? Maybe, but I don't know of any at this point. We need to pass pay equity so that women get the same pay that men do on the job. Do we have Republican support for that? No. So what you have is the Republicans, and I think this is Paul's point, developed a strategy. This is no secret. Literally the day that Obama was inaugurated 6 years ago, and they said, look, our best strategy is to do nothing. Obstruct, 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 do nothing. And when we don't deal with the problems facing America, you blame the president. Not a complicated strategy, but it is a strategy that by and large has worked for them politically. The American people, 63% of the American people don't even know which party controls the House, which party controls the Senate. Most people don't know who their congressman is. So in the middle of that low political consciousness, if the Republicans can obstruct, 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 nothing gets done, the people do know who the president of the United States is. You blame him. I think that is a pathetic strategy. I think it's a cowardly strategy, but that is exactly the strategy that is now being implemented by the Republicans.
Laura in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, is this?
Yeah, hi, Laura. You're
on
the air with Bernie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I didn't know if you were talking to me or someone else from Albuquerque. Senator Sanders, I'm wondering, I'm hearing the do-nothing Congress. Do you think decisions coming out of Congress would be different if we had gender equity in Congress? In other words, if 50% of our congressional representatives were women? And if you do think it would make a difference, how do we get more women elected? How do we get more women interested in running for these political offices?
Thank you, Laurie. Senator Sanders, 1 minute to the break.
Okay. Well, I think the answer, Laura, is yes. I think it would make a difference. I think women who give birth to children, who raise children, have a deeper sense of what goes on in life and the pain that people experience. But I don't think that that is the basic problem. I think you could have 100 women in the United States Senate and still have a bad Senate. I think fundamentally the most important issue is the dominance that big money plays over the political process. And while we are going to fight to make sure that more and more women get involved in the political process, that's just fair. And we have come a long way. We've got a long way to go. I suspect, Laura, that in 10, 20 years, half the elected officials in America will be women. And that's what it should be. But the most important issue is campaign finance reform, so that elected officials are not beholden to big money, but can actually represent their constituents.
More of your calls for Senator Sanders in just a moment. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a day early here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov, and you can easily track him down over on Facebook and Twitter as well. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Janice watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite in Sacramento, California. You are on the air with Bernie.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Sanders, for all that you've done for us. I'm a veteran of U.S. Navy, and I'm speaking for myself and other veterans on the USS Acadia, and I'm going back to the war in the Middle East, and this was back in 1987. Our ship was had to go through the Straits of Hormuz to repair the USS Stark that was hit by an Iraqi missile, and because women on Navy ships at the time were not allowed in combat zone or hazardous duty zones, the order came down from President Reagan, and the whole time we were working on the Stark, in which we faced F-14s, Iranian F-14s, locked and loaded on our ship. We were in combat, but when we were in the Persian Gulf, every member of our ship, 1,300 of us, 300 women and men, were not paid combat pay or hazardous duty pay, whereas every other ship in Bahrain at the time, and I think there were USS Stark, of course, and four other ships parked alongside, were paid hazardous duty and combat pay. And now I want to know if the United States will treat their veterans right and do right by us and give us back pay for that time, that 30 days that we were, and you have no idea what we experienced on a ship that was hit by Exocet missiles. It is the most, I can't even talk about it. So that is my question.
Senator?
Okay, Janice, first of all, thank you for the question and thank you for your service to our country, and I can imagine what you went through. We're talking about the U.S. Acadia 1987.
USS Stark is the ship she was on after the Acadia was hit.
Oh, I'm sorry, U.S. Stark, okay. Janice, I will inquire about that this afternoon.
Great. Thank you very much. And Janice, Kathleen in Council Bluffs, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, it's Kathleen.
Yes, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi, Bernie. I'd vote for you in a second. But anyway, Congress, when they passed giving tax breaks to companies that moved out of the country, how dumb is that? You know, I just wonder about our Congress. They're just not, you know, they're just not very intelligent, some of them.
You know, Kathleen, it is a dumb act, but it is not because people are dumb. The decisions made in Congress, by and large, reflect the interests of the largest corporations and the wealthiest people. when NAFTA was passed, when CAFTA was passed, when permanent normal trade relations with China was passed, and I voted against all of those things, you had corporate America, you had the leading newspapers of America, all pushing for this unfettered free trade. The average American understood that it was not going to be good for our people to give corporations the opportunity to move to China, hire people there for a buck an hour, and then bring their products back in this country. And the result is that we have shut down tens of thousands of factories and lost millions of jobs. But that is what corporate America wanted, and that's what they got.
We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. It's 10 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Harmon here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, a day early. And Richard in Evanston, Illinois, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. Full disclosure, I've sent money to you, and I saw you at Tommy and Evans in Evanston. So
that was a great meeting. Thanks for coming out, Richard.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much. A lot of people were there. My question is the discussion about the do-nothing Congress and the obstructionism. You always hear from the other side, the Republicans, that, you know, where everybody does it, you know. And it seems like people swallow that, and I guess I wanted to hear what you have to say about it. I mean, I would imagine there's an ounce of truth in what they say and a ton of lies, but you're a fair person, I think, and I think, you know, in order for this to ring true with people, they really got to stop listening to mainstream media saying, well, they all do it, and glossing over what these people have done or are doing currently.
Well, Richard, thank you very much. I mean, I think your question is right on. There is an ounce of truth in it. One would be a hypocrite to suggest that, and again, I speak as an independent, that Democrats have never obstructed. Of course they have. But what Republicans do always is take it to an entirely different level. A number of months ago, just as an example, before we finally got through a major piece of veterans legislation, which was passed and signed by the president, I brought forth another piece. And I thought we had all the veterans organizations, the American people behind it. Clearly, we can get this thing passed. And I could only get 56 votes in the Senate because, for a variety of reasons, Republicans filibustered it. It used to be that you use the filibuster only on extraordinary circumstances, unusual circumstances. Now it is every day. Every day, every significant piece of legislation requires 60 votes. Well, you know what? You can't get anything done under those circumstances. And in the House, on major issue after major issue, they don't even take them up. So Richard is right. I mean, the Republicans haven't invented obstructionism. They have taken it to an entirely different level. And it's just the same thing as gerrymandering. Gerrymandering has voting districts have been with us for a couple hundred years. But the Republicans, again, have taken that to an entirely new level, creating the weirdest districts in the world to make sure that they can elect or reelect their members. So, you know, Richard is right. Republicans didn't invent these things, but they've taken it all to a level that we have never seen before.
Candace in Salem, West Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, good afternoon, Senator Sanders and Tom. I just wanted to know, Senator, is this going to help if we get a implement a third party into play? And that would hopefully stop the deterioration of our government and our planet. I just see a slower death with if the Democrats are in play and just a little faster, of course, with the Republicans. And I'll just listen to your answer. Thank you.
Well, you know, you raise a question where there is a lot of disagreement in the progressive community. I think there is a general consensus that today we have a Republican Party that has moved from being a center-right party to a right-wing extremist party. I think there is general acknowledgement that the Democratic Party has moved from being a center-left party, which had its support among the working class in this country, to a centrist party heavily financed by corporate America as well, which leaves a huge vacuum. The political question that you raise is, in today, given political consciousness, is it possible to build a strong, independent, progressive movement? When I was mayor of a small city, the city of Burlington, Vermont, we did that. And by the time I left, I think we had 6 out of 13 members of the city council who were affiliated with our movement when I was mayor. Right now in Vermont, we have probably more progressives, third-party progressives, in the state legislature, I suspect, than any state in the country. But I think to answer the question, can you do it nationally? It's pretty tough. It is pretty tough. Can you do it in a given city? Maybe. Can you do it in a congressional district? Perhaps. One thing that we do know for sure is that there is more and more frustration with the two-party system than we have seen for a very long time, maybe forever, that more and more people, when they fill out their forms, choose not to be parts of the Democratic or Republican Party. Often they choose to be independents. So you ask a good question, and I don't know that there's a magical answer to it. It may be true that you could build third parties here and there and elsewhere, and not nationally, and maybe at some point that takes hold. But that's kind of, I think, where we are today.
Senator, we have a little less than 2 minutes to go. You want to wrap
up? Let me just conclude by saying this. You know, Tom, one of the things that bothers me the most is not that in a democratic society we don't have honest people on both sides who disagree about an issue, whether it's education, healthcare, tax reform, global warming, whatever it may be. That's called democracy. And none of us believe that we have all of the answers. What really bothers me most is that on the most important issues facing this country, I think the media does us an enormous disservice by not allowing that debate to take place, not allowing real discussion to focus on the issues that most people are concerned about. I mentioned Citizens United, probably the most important issue facing America, because the billionaires are able to spend as much as they want. We're going to move toward an oligarchic form of society. Relatively little media discussion on the significance of what we're debating right now on the floor of the United States Senate. The need for jobs. You ask the American people, what is the most important issue impacting you? And you know what people say? We need jobs. You talk to people about wages. We need to raise the minimum wage. You talk about education. People are saying, I can't afford to send my kids to college. Or when they get out of college, they are saddled with these terrible debts. People want to hear a discussion, different ideas as to how we address those issues. And sadly enough, I don't think we're having that conversation. So we have got to drive that debate. You can't wait for the media to do it.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Always. Senator Bernie Sanders. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov and check out his Facebook page and his Twitter feed. We'll be back with a little clip from the president.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So the president last night laid out his concern. We have advisors on the ground, right? Trainers and advisors and people looking after our own people.
but not boots on the ground. So here's what he had to say.
I don't think that unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them. We can give them equipment. We can send our men out there as advisors, but they have to win it, the people of Vietnam, against the communists. We're prepared to continue to assist them, but I don't think that the war can be won unless the people support the effort. And in my opinion, in the last 2 months, the government has gotten out of touch with the people. The repressions against the Buddhists, we felt, were very unwise. Now, all we can do is to make it very clear that we don't think this is the way to win. It's my hope that this will become increasingly obvious to the government, that they will take steps to try to bring back popular support for this very essential struggle.
Well, hasn't every indication from Saigon been that President Diem has no intention of changing his pattern?
If he doesn't change it, of course, that's his decision. He's been there 10 years. As I say, he has carried this burden when he's been counted out on a number of occasions. Our best judgment is that he can't be successful on this basis. We hope that he comes to see that. But in the final analysis, it's the people and the government themselves who have to win or lose this struggle. All we can do is help, and we're making it very clear. But I don't agree with those who say we should withdraw. That'd be a great mistake. That'd be a great mistake.
So, 1962, I had the wrong president, I'm sorry. That was President Kennedy in 1962 talking with Walter Cronkite on the lawn of the White House about how the Vietnamese government was oppressing a substantial minority group within Vietnam, the South Vietnamese government, the Buddhists. Remember the Buddhist monks who were setting themselves on fire in protest of this stuff? If you're old enough to remember, if you're not, it's in the history books and all the documentaries. And the president was saying, you know, why is this government kicking out the Sunnis? Excuse me, the Buddhists. And, you know, if they get their act together and they bring in the Sunnis, I mean the Buddhists, then, you know, we'll be there. And at that point, there were 16,000 advisors in South Vietnam. 82 Americans had died already in Vietnam. 1962. Are we not making the same mistakes? There's a very thoughtful piece over posted by Callie over on Democratic Underground. Why ISIS and not Boko Haram? Consider this. Callie writes, Boko Haram is a threat to the stability of Nigeria, and Nigeria is an oil-producing state, and things are getting worse in Nigeria because of Boko Haram. They've taken over entire regions just like ISIS has. The Nigerian military is, in the words of a former British military attaché, a shadow of what it's reputed to have been. It's fallen apart, short on equipment, including radios and armored vehicles. Morale is low. The country's defense budget accounts for more than a third of the security budget of $5.8 million, but only 10% is allocated to capital spending, etc. In July 2014, Nigeria was estimated to have had the highest number of terrorist killings in the world over the past year. 3,477 people killed in 146 attacks. The governor of Borno, Kashim Shettima, of the opposition ANP, said, Boko Haram are better armed and better motivated than our own troops. Given the present state of affairs, it is absolutely impossible for us to defeat Boko Haram. These Boko Haram, of course, gained fame for kidnapping hundreds of teenage girls who had the audacity to go to school, and now they've been parceled out to Boko Haram senior members as sex slaves or second, third, fourth wives or whatever you want to call it. But we're not doing anything about a Boko Haram. I'm very concerned about this. We have not been attacked, to the best of my knowledge, by Boko Haram. You could say, well, you know, they cut off the heads of a couple of American journalists. Yeah, and Saudi Arabia cut off the heads of 19 people in the previous 3 weeks, including 8 people who committed no violent crime whatsoever. One of them was a schizophrenic woman who was executed for being a witch. Yes, witchcraft is illegal in Saudi Arabia. They publicly behead you on a Friday afternoon in the stadium. Boko Haram, ISIS is just kind of the external arm of Saudi Arabia, at least philosophically. They're Sifali, they're Wahhabists or neo-Wahhabists. hear Obama saying, well, it's only 1,500 troops on the ground and, you know, planes over. You know, we're not going to get involved in this. So the question in my mind now is not what, but when. When is our Gulf of Tonkin moment going to happen? The people old enough to remember the Gulf of Tonkin are dying off or aging out to the point that they're not listened to. The people who read history have never been listened to. And I just think this is, in fact, it's worth revisiting. I want to play that Kennedy clip one more time, or at least the first part of it, up until Walter Cronkite asked the second question. We can include Cronkite's question, the first. No? No, we can't. Okay. All right. So, first of all, Walter Cronkite says, you know, basically what's going on with Vietnam. And here's what Kennedy had to say in 62.
I don't think that unless a
63,
greater
63.
Effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them. We can give them equipment. We can send our men out there as advisors, but they have to win it, the people of Vietnam, against the communists. We're prepared to continue to assist them, but I don't think that the war can be won unless the people support the effort. And in my opinion, in the last 2 months, the government has gotten out of touch with the people. The repressions against the Buddhists, we felt, were very unwise. Now, all we can do is to make it very clear that we don't think this is the way to win. It's my hope that this will become increasingly obvious to the government, that they will take steps to try to bring back popular support for this very essential struggle.
There you go. So this was Jack Kennedy. I'm sorry, it was September 2nd, 1963. It was about a month before he was assassinated. We had 18,000 advisors on the ground in Vietnam. No combat troops on the ground, right? No boots on the ground. Meanwhile, I understand that the Obama administration is training 25,000 barefoot ninjas to go into the Middle East. No boots on the ground. No, it's a terrible joke. This is not funny stuff. So, you know, I get it how the president is stuck between a rock and a hard place. I get this. I get it that, you know, before the beheadings, Americans were opposed to taking on ISIS. Since the beheadings, which got wide publicity, they're in favor of it. I see this as our media ginning up war, basically. I mean, all the time that the media was talking about ISIS is cutting off Jim Foley's head, they were not pointing out that ISIS is a very fragile coalition, essentially. There are a lot of Sunnis who have joined ISIS simply because nowhere else in Iraq is there political space for Sunnis. And they're half the country. And in Syria, they're openly oppressed by the Bashar al-Assad regime, which is Alawite Sunni, Shia. And so you've got, you know, even within ISIS, many, maybe even a majority of the people in ISIS are not fundamentalist Muslim crazies. They're Sunnis who, A, need a paycheck, which they are getting from ISIS, and we could be offering them a paycheck. Building roads, putting up schools, especially for girls. They want a paycheck, and they want some political place. And this all tracks back to L. Paul Bremer and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney kicking the Sunnis out of the Saddam Hussein government.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We de-bathified Iraq, we de-Sunniized Iraq, and then we handed it over to a Shia government, and surprise, the Sunnis are PO'd. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Jasmine in Tacoma, Washington. Sorry we couldn't get your call in for Bernie. Will you take me, Jasmine?
Yes, and the question is, how we the people can change the Congress House terms? Can we start like a petition so they don't serve and stay there that long? So I think they get like a sense of entitlement that they can do whatever they want because they're there for 50, 60 plus years. So if they have a term like the president, that the president know he has two terms and he has a short time to do whatever he needs to do, I think it would be a different environment.
Yeah. I respectfully, I disagree. I would submit to you that, first of all, term limits, and we've seen this at the state level around the country in states that have term limited their legislatures. And what happens is, normally in a non-term limited legislative environment, when new legislators are elected and they come into the body, they do the same thing that you would do on the first day of a new job. You seek out people who've been on the job for a long time, who know how things work, who know where the bodies are buried and know how to get things done, and who know how, you know, the nuances of how the place works. And they seek out somebody to basically mentor them in their new job. And new legislators look for people who've been around for a while. If nobody's been around for a while because of term limits, there is a group that has been around for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in some cases, and those are the lobbyists. So what we see is that when you have term limits, the power, the institutional power of the House and Senate diminishes the, not even the power, the ability of it to stand alone as an institution diminishes, and the power of the lobbyists to control and influence the legislature by, you know, individual members one at a time dramatically increases. So I'm totally opposed to term limits. To your point of entitlement, though, Jasmine, I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of members of Congress, you know, Darrell Issa is a great example, who feel like they can do and say anything. They can lie to the American people. They can lie to their constituents. They can mistreat people. They can abuse people. They can do whatever they damn well please. And they know that they're going to be able to get away with it. And I would say that that's not because Darrell Issa knows he can always run for another term. It's because the Supreme Court said that money, spending money, the act of spending money, which used to be up until 1976 was regulated as a behavior, is not a behavior. It's actually speech under the First Amendment and therefore protected. And so Darrell Issa, who's worth over $700 million, knows that he can always buy the next election. And so if you want to get rid of the sense of entitlement by the parts of, on the part of members of Congress, I would say change the election rules, to, you know, roll back, you know, amend the Constitution to roll back Citizens United, and then change the rules so that people like Darrell Issa can't spend their own money, you know, to get themselves reelected, and they can't go to people like the Koch brothers and get them reelected. Am I making sense, Jasmine?
My other question was the same thing with the Justice of Peace. Is you think they should have a term or they can stay in their job forever? Because I think that's a problem, too.
I think, well, it's a problem in that Justice of the Peace elections are now being funded by the Koch brothers and people like them. I mean, these guys, they set up ALEC to influence state legislators, and now they've got a new organization that's influencing local, literally town politics, these billionaires. Again, it's not a matter of term limits. It's not a matter of, you know, people turn bad when they stay in office for a long time. A lot of people get a lot better. Look at Bernie. He's been in politics his whole entire life for all practical purposes. They, you know, he's gotten better and better and better because he doesn't have to depend on rich people to get him elected. He's from a small state. Jasmine, thank you for the call. So let me just be very clear about my position on this. I have tremendous respect for President Obama. I think that his judgment is among the best we've seen in any president since Jimmy Carter and arguably since Dwight Eisenhower. I think he's a very smart man. He's a very thoughtful man. He plays the long game rather than responding to short-term interests. All of that is laudable. And I think that the caution that he expressed yesterday was good and important. And I think that, you know, let's not forget that the four-point plan that he laid out includes foreign aid. You know, which hopefully will go to things like building schools for girls. And, you know, it's his number one, conduct expanded airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. I'm very ambivalent about that. Although I get the sense of urgency that he has and the political pressure for this, I don't see how he could say no to it, frankly, given the politics of it. Then he says we will increase our support to forces fighting these terrorists on the ground. Great. This sounds a lot like Vietnamization. I think that's what they used to call it. We're not going to fight the war. The Vietnamese are going to fight the war. But, you know, maybe they can pull it off. Maybe history won't repeat itself. I'm skeptical. Number three, use counterterror strategies and work with international partners. That's a pretty important piece. I don't recall that we had a lot of international partners in Vietnam. I think that Australia was with us there for a while. You know, I'm not a scholar of Vietnam, so I shouldn't get into that. But, you know, yeah, working with partners. The most important partners, though, are the countries around the region. I mean, he's going to Saudi Arabia. John Kerry's in Saudi Arabia today. He's going to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia finds itself in a very weird position because ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State is philosophically identical in large part to the more conservative factions within Saudi Arabia who run that country right now. Talk beheadings. They beheaded 18 people last month, including a couple of people who were busted for drugs and a woman who was busted for witchcraft. And they do it publicly. They do it as a spectacle. This is Saudi Arabia. So Kerry is asking them to go to war against the people who are, you know, Sunni fundamentalists. And they are Sunni fundamentalists. And Qatar and UAE, I mean, they've been sponsoring or supporting these various sheikhs who show up to raise money for ISIS. Obama says this is going to be a sustained effort. Today is the 13th anniversary of 9/11. So, you know, if you've got thoughts on 9/11, feel free to call. I would say that the big lesson that I learned from 9/11, and I wrote a book about this called We the People, which I think is one of the better books I've written. It's one of the more obscure books I've written. But it's because I think probably because it's a comic book, but it's a 130-page illustrated 13-chapter history of the United States that leads up to, you know, 9/11 and shortly thereafter and how Bush badly responded to it. I think Bush's response to 9/11 was all out of proportion and was frankly stupid. He did exactly what bin Laden said in advance. In 1998, bin Laden said, this is what we want Bush to do. Or this is what we want America to do. He laid it out. And then he did it. And then Bush did exactly what bin Laden wanted him to do. And we are right in the middle of the quagmire that bin Laden wanted us to be in the middle of. Now, you know, Boko Haram in Nigeria is worse than ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And I would submit to you that if our press had bureaus in Nigeria, so they're not there. It's more dangerous there in their mind. And there's not a strong U.S. infrastructure to support them. So we're not seeing the pictures. We're not hearing the stories. We're not seeing the refugees. But there are millions of refugees in Nigeria. Hundreds of thousands of people dead as a result of Boko Haram, which is another fundamentalist Sunni group that is, you know, not that different from ISIS. Why are we ignoring one and fighting the other? Well, I mean, Nigeria has oil, but it's mostly locked up by Shell, which is a Dutch company. Of course, you know, Iraq's oil, is Dick Cheney engineered that so that it was being sold to China as well as Iraq. It's like, this is just a mess. And again, I bring back my question, when will our Gulf of Tonkin moment happen? I predict our Gulf of Tonkin moment is going to happen when our flights, when our planes flying over that country get hit by surface-to-air missiles, which are, you know, increasingly sophisticated, shoulder-fired, all these kind of things. When one of our planes gets taken down and one or more of our pilots gets taken hostage, and ISIS brings them out and says, we're going to behead this guy. And then the president says, no, you're not, and suddenly you've got 1,000 special forces on the ground, and boom, we're at war. So, you know, do you think I'm crazy? Do you have a different idea about how this might play out? What do you think is going to be our Gulf of Tonkin moment? Because I'm sitting here having watched Jack Kennedy say, no, we're not going to pull out of Vietnam, but we're not going to put boots on the ground other than advisors. We're just going to, you know, support them from the air. I remember that, and it looks to me like it's happening all over again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I think that there's a very good chance that this president might be wise enough to avoid making the mistakes Lyndon Johnson did, but there's another president coming in 2 years.
very, very hypnopompically ugly. The good. Hershey's Pizza. This Baltimore restaurant has started a unique campaign to raise awareness about domestic violence. Over the next few days, Hershey's Pizza will give a free slice of pizza to any customer who brings in a jersey of former Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice, the guy who was caught on camera assaulting his fiancée. Hersh will donate $2.70 to a local domestic violence charity for every Ray Rice jersey exchanged this way, and says it will use the old jerseys as toilet paper, which, while probably a joke, sounds like a great idea. The bad. Senator Ted Cruz. During a speech on the Senate floor this week, the Texas senator claimed that a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United would ban Saturday Night Live for making fun of politicians. Seriously, take a look.
Under this amendment, 49 Democrats have signed their name to, Congress would have the power to make it a criminal offense. Lorne Michaels could be put in jail under this amendment for making fun of any politician. That is extraordinary, it is breathtaking, and it is dangerous.
It's also a flat-out lie. All a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United would do is allow Congress to regulate the amount of money billionaires can use to try and bribe our politicians. It has nothing to do with banning political speech. As usual, Senator Cruz is more interested in shilling for his billionaire backers than he is in telling the truth. And the very, very ugly Phil Robertson. During an appearance on Tony Perkins' Washington Watch radio show Tuesday, the Duck Dynasty star suggested that AIDS, oh, not again, was God's punishment for homosexuality. Take a listen.
Do you think it's a coincidence that all of these debilitating and literally it can cause death diseases follow that kind of conduct? God says, one woman, one man, and everybody says, oh, that's old hat, that's that old Bible stuff. And I'm thinking, well, let's see now. A clean guy, disease-free guy, and a disease-free woman, they marry and they keep their sex between the two of them. They're not going to get chlamydia and gonorrhea and syphilis and AIDS. It's safe.
And people are worried about radical Islam? Christian Taliban is alive and well in America, and Phil Robertson is living, breathing, and bearded proof of it. That's very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Jim in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Hey, Jim, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
You remember during the Vietnam War, there was a joke about Vietnamization, and it was about Purcell used South Vietnamese Army rifle M16, never fired and only dropped once.
It's hard to make out exactly what you're saying, Jim. But no, I don't think I remember that. I didn't catch every word. I'm sorry. What's your point?
It's a joke on how the South Vietnamese, after years and years of Vietnamization, building a South Vietnamese army,
right.
And when the North Vietnamese came in, they just dropped their rifles and ran away.
Yeah, they did frequently.
Same thing that happened. And you were making a good point by showing what Kennedy said earlier. And what I'm getting at is that where is this going to end? How can we possibly win anything in this if they're outnumbered ISA 10-1 and had all these arms and they dropped them and ran off?
Yeah.
There's no way I can see that there's a win in this. And our here we are again. We're doing exactly, I'm pretty sure they're going to go in and do exactly what they've done before. That means the leadership that's going to go in and try to, you know, challenge ISA. And they're going to come in with these almost set battlefield practices and tactics of World War II and bomb and strafe and bomb and strafe. And then eventually they're going to ask for boots on the ground. And then eventually we're going to have to put boots on the ground. And we'll be right back to where we were.
Right.
And they don't really, I think they don't really understand the mindset of third world countries.
Right. And Saudi Arabia has one of the largest air forces in that region. We have supplied them with mind-boggling numbers of F-15s and F-16s, I believe. And, fully modern, American-equipped. Saudi Arabia could be doing this. Qatar could be doing this. The UAE could be doing this. But they're not. And you have to ask yourself the question, if Saudi Arabia, their next-door neighbor,
isn't willing to participate in taking out ISIS. And Saudi Arabia, in fact, helped fund ISIS. What the hell are we doing there? I think this is a real serious question. Jim, thanks for the call. Bob in Ontario, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, John. It's the three dirtiest words in the English language that are bothering me today.
Can you say them on the radio?
Those three dirty words are politics, taxation, and the banks.
Yeah.
It was surely taxation that gives this Congress all the money it needs to create war. We are the largest aggressors on the face of the earth.
Yeah, if you do away with taxes, I mean, as much as the Koch brothers would love us to do away with taxes, if you do away with taxes, you're not going to do away with war. Bob, I think you're going at it backwards. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Senator Sanders. I know he's gone.
Yeah.
If they're going to send our boys back into combat, right, even in airplanes, they get knocked out.
Yeah. If you don't think that airplanes are part of combat and that those people are functionally boots on the ground, ask John McCain how that worked out back 40 years ago.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You're going to send them back into combat. And we got the Veterans Administration don't get enough money. How about a transaction tax to pay for those veterans? And also,
you're talking about a financial, you're talking about the stat tax, the Robin Hood tax, the financial transaction tax on Wall Street?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And pay for the student loans they got out, because you're eventually going to ask them to go in the military.
Yep.
So pay their education, pay for the Veterans Administration, and charge it to Wall Street.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. Thanks a lot for the call, Corky. Greg in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom. On this anniversary of 9/11, I know that the effect of radical Islam is still fresh in the mind of a lot of Americans. But I kind of wanted to call in to highlight a different perspective, what effect ISIS has had on the Middle East. And some of those repercussions might actually be a good thing for the country. So I kind of wanted to
make your argument.
Well, I kind of want to take a different perspective. If you look at political Islam epidemiologically as a mind virus, you can liken it to communism or Nazism, for example, decades ago. And if you look at it that way, a major vector of spreading is idealistic young men, basically, who join up to fight. And what inevitably happens is that nation states actually put aside their differences and start aligning against this. With response to Nazism, you got the Allies. With respect to communism, you got NATO. So I kind of see the same thing happening in the Middle East and with Arab countries. Like, there's an unprecedented move now for Sunni countries, especially like Saudi Arabia and Egypt. They've organized against terror groups to the point where, in an unprecedented, there's now support for disarming Hamas, for example. They're taking the other side where they've previously taken the side of the resistance movements. They're now saying, you know what, our regime could be toppled by these movements because they're Sunni.
Right.
And I think that's a big deal, and it changes a lot of the politics in the Arab world. So I think these governments can be counted to fight the insurgents themselves.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a brilliant analysis, Greg. I talked about that briefly, I think a week or so, maybe a week and a half ago, about how the Nazis were actually a death cult, and Tojo had built a death cult around the Japanese emperor as the reincarnation of the sun god. And so you had Japanese pilots who were competing for an opportunity to fly kamikaze missions into the decks of U.S. warships. And you had German soldiers who believed. I knew some of these guys. I mean, they were set in their 70s when I knew them in the 1970s. But, you know, I knew some of these guys who really and truly believed that Adolf Hitler was bringing about the return of Jesus Christ, that this was going to be the 1,000 years of peace, the millennium. This is what Hitler sold them. One Reich, one Führer, one nation, one Führer, one world. You know, that basically we would have peace on earth for 1,000 years once we just locked down the whole planet under Nazi control. And when people in Germany and people in Japan, as a consequence of their defeat, woke up from those two cults, they were genuinely horrified. And I frankly believe that people in the region left to their own devices. I mean, if the United States were to say, you know, we're going to have nothing to do with this at all, good luck, Charlie,
There is so much money in that region, and there is such sophisticated weaponry in the hands of people like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and UAE that they could easily defeat ISIS. They could do it in a week or two if they wanted to. I mean, it's just that they don't want to. I mean, Saudi Arabia having a draft, oh, my God. I mean, you know, Saudi citizens get, what, $50,000, $100,000 a year just for being citizens? It's even better.
What bothers me in America, I think the real danger is the technology. The young men are here. A lot of the people, you know, in Britain, there's 500 people that went to join ISIS.
Right, I mean, presumably about 100 Americans.
Exactly. And so I think the real danger is from the people who never left, who never flew over there to fight, and they're right here, and who knows what they're going to do.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think that the, you know, identifying this as a thought virus and as a cult, you know, and cults use thought viruses, mind viruses, is absolutely the way we need to do it. Greg, thank you for the call. Very, very thoughtful analysis. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And to say that it's a contagious mind virus cult, much like communism was back in the 60s when it infected North Vietnam, I think is another great metaphor. And welcome back. Gant in Thompson Station, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Gant, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thanks for taking my call. We're talking about the Middle East, we're talking about ISIS, and I still just see in the great grand scheme, the big picture, if this is another corporate neoconservative opportunity to jump in there and make big money. I mean, what you've alluded to in so many ways is how much this whole thing doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense. And what really freaks me out more than anything is you've alluded to religion several times, is the fundamentalist right-wingers, the right-wing Christians especially. Bill Boehner called this a holy war.
John Boehner, you mean?
Yeah, I'm so sorry. John Boehner, yeah. I'm thinking of the mayor of Nashville at one time. John Boehner called it a holy war, knowing full good and well that it's not a holy war.
A holy war by on our part? Like, you know, we're the good Christian crusaders fighting the evil Muslims?
Yeah, he said that on the floor after. He said that in his interview after Obama had spoken.
Holy cow. I missed that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a holy war. Ted Cruz says the same thing. Michelle Bachmann says the same thing. And your Phil Robertson comment was classic. And that kind of was where I was kind of going. It's like, hey, yeah, you're really afraid of Islam. I'm scared of the New Age fundamentalist Christians who have bastardized what the writings of Christ were really about.
Yeah, they're doing to Christianity what Boko Haram and ISIS are doing to Islam.
Right. And I don't know. It's an opportunity. Corporations and, I mean, you're right. There's going to be a Gulf of Tonkin incident, and I couldn't agree more. I believe it's going to be a plane shot down and a pilot beheaded or something of that nature. And I know Obama has done everything he can to not appease the neocons. I think he does it deliberately because he doesn't want to be involved in... you're right. He's a smart man. He's a tolerant man. He's patient. He sees the big picture. And I'm telling you what, corporations and the neocons, they just want a war.
Mm-hmm.
The first was Iran. Weapons of mass destruction. Well, now, wait, aren't they siding with us now, or aren't we trying to use them in some way?
Yeah, we actually cooperated with Iran last week in some sort of a strike.
Okay, yeah, well, when Romney was running for president, he wanted a $2 trillion military budget. Don't tell me he wasn't going to go to war. They wanted a war. Okay, so now they've got this opportunity. No war, no money. I mean, I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but... I mean, I just we're backing ourselves into a corner, and
Gant, this is nothing new. This is the comment that Abe Lincoln made during the Civil War when he talked about the New York bankers who were profiting over the Civil War. I used it as an epigraph in one of the chapters in my book on equal protection. He said, I wish these guys would get a bullet to the head. That's how, and it took a lot to really PO Abe Lincoln.
And it's just, you know, the war profiteers. I'm with you. They're out there, and they're pushing this thing, and they're on TV. You know, these consultants, these retired generals who are on the board of defense contractors, and then come on the major television networks as if they were impartial, nonpartisan consultants. Oh, let me tell you how it is. Well, they do need more of this particular weapon system. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Ellen, may I play 60 seconds of John Kennedy for you?
Sure you can, and I'm actually got you nailed right now on Skype from our White House booth, too.
Okay, cool. This is September 2nd, 1963, a month before he was assassinated, in an interview with Walter Cronkite about Vietnam. We had 16,000 advisors on the ground. 83 Americans had died at that point. No boots on the ground, though, no combat troops. Here's Jack Kennedy.
I don't think that unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them. We can give them equipment. We can send our men out there as advisors, but they have to win it, the people of Vietnam, against the communists. We're prepared to continue to assist them, but I don't think that the war can be won unless the people support the effort. And in my opinion, in the last 2 months, the government has gotten out of touch with the people. The repressions against the Buddhists, we felt, were very unwise. Now, all we can do is to make it very clear that we don't think this is the way to win. It's my hope that this will become increasingly obvious to the government, that they will take steps to try to bring back popular support for this very essential struggle.
Replace the word Buddhist with the word Sunni, and aren't we deja vu all over again?
Well, very, very much so. And that was really the focus of the briefing, which is actually still going on as I speak to you. And they are now saying, well, the United States had armed the Syrian opposition years ago. Well, if they had totally armed the Syrian opposition, although we obviously gave some help, would it have fallen into ISIL hands? But now they're saying that the United States has been providing assistance to the Syrian opposition for a year. What kind is very unclear, and they're not about to say.
Well, isn't ISIL part of the Syrian opposition?
Well, the thing is that they're saying is that there are various parts of the Syrian opposition, including things like the Free Syrian Army, which has been, quote unquote, a moderate. And so that's one issue. Now, there is another issue that I tried to bring up today, but I came down to do you at the White House basement today. And that is that yesterday it came out that Assad from Syria had some more chemical weapons that he didn't give up to the United Nations, and the United Nations is saying that he has used them. Now, as you know, the president in his address last night just basically said, you know, that we're going to deal with Syria, but no one wants to talk about this particular issue.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that the chemical weapon gas that he's using is chlorine. And
not difficult to get a hold of.
Well, not just that. You've got water treatment plants all over Syria where they have legitimate stores, large quantities of chlorine, as do we all over the United States. So it may well be that all of his, quote, military poison gas was destroyed by the U.S. and Russia. But, you know, he still has chlorine for water treatment, and now he's starting to use that as a weapon. Which category does that fall into?
I've been talking to some people who are also very concerned. This is sort of unrelated but related in terms of weaponizing Ebola virus by putting it or taking people who have it and putting them into areas that we don't want them to be in.
Oh, geez.
So there's a lot of this
kind
of going on with either viruses, legitimate chemicals, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay. On some other fronts, the president also said through his spokesperson today that they are going to have a more systematic set of airstrikes. They were pressed very hard by some of the press as to whether Britain was actually going to participate in these airstrikes, and they would not say. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, some other news that's going on. President went to the Pentagon for the 9/11 ceremony today. They also had a moment of silence. Senator Schumer got an 18-0 committee vote on the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism bill. This apparently allows victims to actually sue governments that they think have harbored terrorists, etc. There was a loophole in the law that did not allow for that, so now it is. Also, Senator Hatch went on the today. He went after the Democrats. He said, well, the Democrats want to end offshore tax breaks. And he said, they're despicable. How come they care about economic and not national security? And he said, the Democrats are only doing this because it's an election year. I don't
really
know what planet Senator Hatch is on, but it's not ours.
Really?
Yeah, that's what he said.
That's astounding. That's astounding.
I like to give you astounding news sometimes because it blows my mind.
Yeah.
Also, ranking member Cummings, Elijah Cummings from Maryland, he wanted and wrote Daryl Issa a letter requesting them to hold hearings on the Home Depot security breach. They said that this is the largest one that they have ever had, that they want to understand this because obviously this also has to do with if they can get into Home Depot, can they get into government files, et cetera. Also, Secretary Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations spoke with the two Afghan candidates. Today, as you know, there is some question about who's legitimate, who's not legitimate presidential candidate, et cetera. The decision's supposed to come down. He's urging them to take a larger look at Afghanistan rather than their own personal interests. Lots of luck on that one.
Mm-hmm.
A Molotov cocktail was lobbed at Emanuel Cleaver's office, representative from Missouri. This is the second one in 6 years.
African American
middle of the morning. It didn't hurt anybody.
Yeah, and we should add an African American congressman from a largely white state, Missouri.
Absolutely. Now, this is really interesting, and it's very broad. The White House put out a one sheet today, actually it was one and a half sheets, about the president joining the European Union to intensify and coordinate new sanctions against Russia.
Yeah, and these, I was reading this in the Financial Times this morning, these ones will actually bite ExxonMobil, which has a lot of commentators going, huh? Really? Because this will be the first time that the sanctions actually went after, you know, ExxonMobil and BP both actually have
well,
a $50 billion contract.
You know,
with
we live in a very multicultural, multi-financial, across shore world.
Yeah, yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see if those big corporations with the incredible lobbying power they have start pushing back against them.
They will.
It's going to be a fun ride, or an interesting ride.
That's
Ellen,
for sure.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com and free-don.org. Ellen, always great talking with you.
Thank you.
Have a great day. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. And Holly Mosher is on the line with us, a filmmaker and executive producer of the new movie Pay to Play. And the website is Pay to Play, as in the number two, P-A-Y, number two, P-L-A-Y, P-A-Y, two, P-L-A-Y, dot nationbuilder.com. And Holly, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here, Tom. I'm really excited.
Thanks for joining us. What is Pay to Play?
Well, pay to play is a system that we currently have in our government where the money that's cycled in, you know, is really stolen, the people's money. It gets taken by the politicians, and then the votes are happening, and they're paying back their lobbyists. The lobbyists talk to the politicians and really, you know, have control. We have an oligarchy. There was that Gillens and Page study that showed that, you know, the politicians are voting almost 99% of the time with the 1%, the interest of the 1%, the lobbyists. And so in our film, we really talk about how we can break that cycle and change things and take back our democracy.
Yeah, and you do a brilliant job of it. The movie is called Pay to Play, and it's opening now, right? Where
yes.
can people see this?
Right now it's in New York, and then we got extended. So we're going to be next week in New York. Actually, starting tomorrow, we'll be in L.A., D.C., and New York. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we're having tons of house party screenings, and we're going to be in Madison and Cincinnati and Columbus, Ohio, and Dallas. And we're really trying to take this across the country to have this dialogue about getting a 28th Amendment that corporations are not people and money is not speech.
So if somebody wanted to do a house party and show this movie, what do they do?
Oh, they just go to our website, which is pay2play.tv, and they go to the screenings page, and there's a link for host your own screening. And it's really easy. We made it very affordable. You can pass a hat so that you can cover your cost for the DVD and invite, you know, 10, 20, 50 people over, or find a place, you know, screen at your library or screen at a college campus and have this dialogue. We have a whole community screening kit so people can lead the dialogue about the changes. We actually highlight 6 solutions in the film, and we think, you know, we need a variety of solutions to really fix our democracy.
And I should, just in the interest of full disclosure, note that I'm in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What are your 6 solutions?
Well, we have... We actually go out on a limb and go with compulsory voting. I've actually lived in Brazil where it was compulsory and it was no big deal. Everybody's just expected to vote, kind of like jury duty. So I'd like to have that discussion here because then you really see who the people want in power. Right now our voter turnout's dismal. And in Australia, when they started compulsory voting, it was at 24 or 25%. And then the next year it was at 90 something percent. So I'd like to see that here. Then we have disclosure, public financing, free airtime, constitutional amendment. And all of our solutions are online on our solutions page.
That's great. And it's pay2play.tv is the website.
Yes.
Okay, great. I don't know how I got this Nation Builder thing, but that is great. Holly, you're doing...
It takes you there. They're linked.
Oh, I see. Okay, you're doing God's work. It's yes. It's a marvelous movie. I hope a lot of people check it out. And thank you so much for dropping by today.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Good talking with you.
Hope to see you at the movies.
Indeed. Indeed. I look forward
yes.
to it. Thank
yes.
you.
Okay. Bye.
10 minutes past the hour. Mark in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's up? Mark is not listening to his phone. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, hi, Tom. I wanted to talk to Bernie about what have we learned the lessons from 9/11 since today's anniversary. I was just thinking, it seems like Al-Qaeda done got bigger with ISIS, and then 2008, the meltdown, the too big to fail done got bigger. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe anything that we learned for the 99% is the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. And that done kind of fizzled out. I wanted to talk to you about this. I was thinking the problem with the Occupy movement not making as much noise as when they started is it's a conflict between the young people and the baby boomers, which we are. And since most of our pensions and retirement is tied up in Wall Street, I think us older baby boomers told the young people, chill out, don't make too much noise, because if you occupy Wall Street, you guys can't even find a job. You got to come live with us, so leave Wall Street alone.
I never said
that. So I'm thinking to solve that problem, we're going to have a compromise. So I was thinking, you know, my logical thought using Thomas Paine common sense is the Federal Reserve. We could compromise with that if us baby boomers say, okay, we take control of the Federal Reserve and we could protect our pensions and retirements, and then we say, okay, as long as we have a safety net, nest egg for us old farts, then y'all young guys, y'all could recycle work and save the planet with the environment.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I it makes a lot of sense, although I would say that you are wildly exaggerating the role and the power that the Federal Reserve has. The ability of a company to dump their pension benefits when the company is going through bankruptcy or when the company is being sold was the result of legislation in Congress that was passed during the Reagan era that facilitated these mergers and acquisitions. And basically, before Reagan became president, it was illegal for a company to discharge their pension obligations, even with bankruptcy. They couldn't do it. They had to have that money constantly in the bank, and it had to be in an insulated account. And if they went through bankruptcy, that didn't go through bankruptcy. It got handed off to the federal agency that follows up on those kind of things. Since then, the protections and we're seeing this played out in Detroit right now, for example. The protections of pensioners have just disintegrated. And I think we need to, as part of rolling back Reaganomics and rolling back the damage that the Reagan era did to this country, we need to roll back those changes in law. That has nothing to do with the Fed. I agree that the Fed is a big problem, and I think that the Fed should be part of the Treasury Department. And I think it's crazy that for the Fed to buy bonds, it has to buy them through the big banks on Wall Street. Another law brought to you by Republicans in Congress. And, so that the banks are guaranteed profits no matter what the Fed does. I think all of that is wrong. So good points, Jesse. You raised some really, really good points. Abdullah in Chicago. Hey, Abdullah, you wanted to talk about ISIS?
Yes, hi. I decided to call in response to something called briefly a little while ago and made a really eloquent point about the dangers of sort of U.S. intervention and the sort of benefit of a homegrown solution to ISIS. I'm certain you remember, it was maybe 10 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to preface just by saying I'm an Arab American. I was born and raised in New York City, lived through 9/11, knew people in the towers and all of that. And that sort of all of my education, including my graduate work, has all been in Middle East studies, and I've spent quite a bit of time in the region.
Okay.
And I think that's a great idea. I think it's a fact that U.S. intervention does more harm than good, especially U.S. military intervention, most of the time. But I guess something troubling that I have been hearing from a lot of sort of pundits and a lot of the media is things like what the caller sort of closed with, which was, who knows how many ISIS,
American recruits,
are still in the United States. And I think that's a really dangerous position to have, and I think it's a really dangerous statement to make because it calls into question the sort of patriotism and really like the value of Arab and Muslim and sort of Middle Eastern Americans
right. Everywhere.
And I guess we've seen that position in U.S. history before.
Yeah, it's an excellent point, Abdullah, and it's also kind of a variation on neo-McCarthyism, where they were looking for a communist under every bed. Now they're looking for an ISIS devotee under every bed. We need to take a deep breath and stop the hysteria. Thank you for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, this is nuts. I thought we were the land of the free and the home of the brave, not the land of the free and the home of the weak, kneed, and terrified. Welcome back. Donald in Armada, Michigan, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm in Armada, Michigan, Tom.
Okay. Hey, Donald. You wanted to talk about term limits?
How are you doing?
Good.
I wanted to comment on the term limit thing that you had talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got a great way to resolve that. My partner and I have been talking about a lot of different things about politics, but we brought that's come up a number of times. And what we got out of it was, why not hire a permanent position to each congressional and Senate office as the advisor to learn everything about that office, all the bills passed from that office, everything. It's a permanent position, not paid by that office, but allocated from that office for that position. And when that person came into that office, that advisor would help them through all those different problems that he had. Then once that advisor became well-rounded in that office, when the next two candidates ran for office after the primaries, they would be required to take a class with that advisor before they even took the office. I think that would take care of the problem, and that would, the term limit thing would go away as far as not having, as far as having somebody who's well-rounded or understands the office. You won't have to worry about that anymore. You could educate these guys before they came in by that advisor. What do you think, Tom?
I disagree. I think that having somebody like Ted Kennedy in the Senate for decades, having somebody like Robert Byrd in the Senate for multiple decades, these guys become the institutional memory of the body. And you'll recall during the rush to stumble into Iraq, Robert Byrd was the guy who stood up and said, wait a minute. And if you're suggesting that having somebody who's not elected become the institutional memory of the body because there's something wrong with people who are elected, I would submit to you that what's wrong with people who are elected today is not that they are elected. It's that, and it's not that they've been around too long. It's that the system has been changed. It's as if the football field, instead of 50 yards on either side of the center line, the 50-yard line, you've got 60 or 70 yards on one side that the Democrats have to play on and 30 or 40 yards on the other side that the Republicans are playing on because because of corporate money. And you know, we've got this corrupt system. The game itself has been corrupted. And that's and you wouldn't blame the football players for that if you discovered that they were, you know, trying a lot harder or, you know, even doing things that they shouldn't do to win the game. I mean, you might blame them for that, but we've actually legalized all this stuff. The stuff that we used to call bribery, we've legalized. The Koch brothers can own politicians. For that matter, you know, Saudi Arabia can own politicians. They certainly own a piece of Fox News, and, you know, second largest investor in Fox News is Saudi. It's just, I don't think that the problem is our elected officials. I think it's the system, and the system was created in large part by the Supreme Court, or at least modified by the Supreme Court, and that's the cancer in this system. Am I making sense here, Donald?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I think what the real problem is that you have those issues, and there's no way to... There doesn't seem to be any way to take care of it. And
well, yeah, there are. If you want to diminish the benefits of incumbency, then have public financing of elections and finance people who are challenging incumbents in a way that, you know, proportionally represents the advantage of incumbency. There's a whole variety of ways to do this, and other countries have done it very successfully. We have not, because our Supreme Court has said money should trump everything. Donald, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening to KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor, the president is wrong in thinking that a violent act is going to lead to some kind of peaceful resolution among people who have sectarian differences from better than 90 years. I want to give a shout out to General Chuck Hagel because he said it. He said, this is all about some oil. And it is, sir. When the president was speaking last night, he said, you know, we can do a political solution in Syria. You know why he said that? Because Syria has a big brother called the Russians, and they'll kick our butt on land. What we need right now is for some people to get in front of the White House, about 1,000 people with some signs saying, we don't want no more war. We don't want no more killing. Okay? Talk to these people. Help them build their schools. Help them develop an economy. We don't need to drop no bombs on nobody 50,000 miles away from us. It don't make no sense at all. And I was shocked to hear the president, a peaceful man, a good man, been corrupted by the system. He's just as violent as the two guys that created ISIS. My favorite senator, not McCain, he's number two, Lindsey from South Carolina. Lindsey from South Carolina and your boy down in Arizona, they created all this ISIS stuff. I mean, it's like they get a kickback, a commission when there's some war going on somewhere in the world. Don't you realize, you know, they showed those two guys being beheaded. Show what goes on in war.
Yeah.
Show what goes on when a bomb is dropped on somebody.
Yeah.
Get out there. If you're close to him, you go yourself, Professor. Get a sign out there. We don't want no more war. This is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we should open a recruitment office here in Washington, D.C. for senators who want to fight in the Middle East. Morris, well said. Thank you very much for the call. Connie in Freeland, Michigan. Hey, Connie.
Yeah. A couple weeks ago, or last week, you had someone on about dental.
Dr. June Kim.
Programs.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just, there was someone that called that needed dental work. And I just wanted to let people know that there is a program called Mission of Mercy that I participated in a couple years ago. And if they go out to a website and look up Mission of Mercy, they can find information on what's going to be in their area.
Okay. Great. Connie, thank you for that. Mission of Mercy sounds great. Thank you very much for the info. Amy in St. Mary's, Georgia. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Yes, Tom. A lot of people have had such good points that I really have very little left to say, except that I think we've lost our media. I remember watching Orwell Rolls in His Grave, and it was a game changer for me, and books by John Pilger and Chalmers Johnson. I just think it's so much bigger than us. And the youth of today, I know I work as a tutor for mainly high school students, and most of them, even though they're getting ready for the standardized testing to get into college, most of them have told me candidly that they don't really read. And it seems like if we don't get our media back, if we don't get to hear voices like yours and Amy Goodman's, and before that Phil Donahue, who was of course summarily dismissed from MSNBC, I don't really know how this is going to change, because I felt sick watching Obama last night, and I basically like him, but it was exactly what you were thinking about Vietnam, because you and I are roughly the same age. It's just, we really need the media. We really need people to know the truth.
Yeah.
And they're only getting it from alternative media, which is, God forbid, if we lose the Internet, you know, if we lose net neutrality, because that's a beacon of hope. But young people are not reading. They're not reading the books that are on my shelf, your shelf, you know, a lot of people that have learned through alternative media what the good authors are, who's telling. Well, it's hard to say the truth. Everybody's definition of truth is different. But, I mean, people that look at our empire like Chalmers Johnson did before he passed away, it's just so it's so larger than us. It's defeating at times.
Yeah, I am with you, Amy. And what we're talking about is the corporatization of America, the monopolization of America. And this was all made possible by Ronald Reagan's 1982 decision to stop enforcing the Sherman antitrust law, and to let corporations get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then over the next 3 years, he made a number of changes to the tax code, things like allowing CEOs to get paid with stock options so they no longer give a rat's ass about their employees, about their community, about their customers. They just care about their stock price. And, you know, we now have these giant corporations that dominate literally every sector of America, whether it's food, communications, telecommunications, media, you name it. There's five companies that own it. And they act as cartels. They don't act as competitors. And we really, really, really need to be changing that. The Reaganomics has done so much damage to this country. Amy, thank you for the call. Very well said. Carl in Chicago. Hey, Carl, you want to talk about the embassy in Iraq?
How are you? Yeah.
Good.
You were looking for a Gulf of Tonkin parallel.
Yeah.
This thing is, to me, seems like it's being so carefully orchestrated. Look at these two journalists get beheaded so close to 9/11, prior to 9/11,
right,
to start stirring up war drums. And here McCain goes on the air and says, you know, I told Obama we should have bombed Syria a long time ago. As a matter of fact, I could show him where to bomb right now. And to me, the perfect Gulf of Tonkin incident would be the biggest target that we built in Iraq, which is the largest embassy in the world, bigger than the Vatican, and
which is its own country.
Yes, and if it was an inside job that blew up the embassy that we had in Iraq, that would be the trigger to start the war drums going and start marching.
Well, here's the important thing to keep in mind, Carl. It doesn't need to be an inside job. Just as there are forces in the United States who want us to go to war, the military-industrial complex and the neocon chicken hawks, you know, associated with them, there are also people in the Middle East who want us to go to war. ISIS wants us to go to war. They would love to get some American soldiers that they could massacre and they could turn into viral videos and say, oh, it's the infidels coming to get us. So it could just as easily be them. I think you're right. That could be the what was it, USS Nimitz was the ship? What was the ship in the Gulf of Tonkin that was blown up or that they said was blown up? I think it was the Nimitz.
You know, I forgot the name, but the interesting thing is people have to realize this. War is business. That's all it is. It's just big business.
Well, Smedley Butler said it right. War is a racket. Oh. It's not just business. It's a racket. It's a rigged business game. And the only people who ever win in war are the people who make the weapons of war. Excellent point, Carl. Thank you for calling and making it. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, and we will be back with more. Your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day, a couple other things I want to share with you. An interesting story coming out of Sweden. Is the era of conservative rule in Sweden coming to an end? I wouldn't share that with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, in our new book, Dan Sisson and I, The American Revolution of 1800 is now available in pretty much anywhere you look. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Very interesting news coming out of Sweden. And you can read this over on The Guardian's website, theguardian.com. And the headline is, as Swedish elections loom, cracks start to show in Nordic model. And actually what they're saying is that the cracks are starting to show not in the Nordic model, but in the reinvented Nordic model by the so-called moderates. Sweden has a more conservative government and has had one for some years now than historically they had. And, in fact, it's called the Moderate Party. And they privatized much of their schools. They privatized part of their trains. They privatized some of the banks that had been nationalized. They privatized elderly care. A lot of these things that they used to consider part of the commons, Sweden has privatized over the last decade as the so-called moderates took control of the political process. And now the Swedes are having buyer's remorse. Quoting from this article in The Guardian by Philip Olterman in Stockholm, he says, with the rise of the far-right Sweden Democrats, who are polling at 10%, income gaps have increased by a third since this stuff happened, more than any other OECD country, and unemployment benefits have fallen below the European average. The number of employees in privately provided services for school, privately provided schools, in other words, this is their equivalent of charter schools, right? It has risen almost fivefold, from 5% in 1993 to 23% in 2011. So what's happening? They're privatizing their schools. About a quarter of the schools are now privatized. Roger Jacobson, the head of education, says, quote, overnight, the debate changed. For years, people had been accusing schools run by private equity of pocketing the state's money and putting it into their offshore bank accounts, but now it looked like those companies weren't even capable of running a business properly. In other words, the schools are failing, these privatized schools. They're ripping people off. They're not only putting the money in the Swiss bank accounts, they don't know how to run a damn school. The Program for International Student Assessment said that the home of the Nobel Prize, that's Sweden, saw their schools drop below the OECD average in math, reading comprehension, natural science, and problem solving. Grade inflation, meanwhile, was rampant. Well, what do you expect if you got a private for-profit corporation? You know, they're going to try and make themselves look good with grade inflation, and they're going to try and cut back on teaching. I mean, it's make more money. The care sector, the article points out, experienced its own privatization scandal in 2011. And the Dagens Nyheter, this is a newspaper in Sweden, reported that an elderly care center in Kopargarden, run by the private company Carima, was catastrophically neglecting its customers, weighing diapers. These are old people who had to wear diapers, weighing their diapers to see if they could be used for longer, thus ensuring maximum usage, lower costs, and maximum profits. Complaints about poor service and frequent delays in the high-speed train between Malmo and Stockholm also swung the mood against the privatization of the railways. Under Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt, he's the current moderate leader, Sweden for the first time discovered an appetite for tax cuts. They call them moderates, we call them Republicans. Wealth tax, income tax, corporate taxes all slashed. So where are the Swedes at on this now? Surveys of attitudes show the Swedes' willingness to pay higher taxes has risen recently. Why? Because they've seen their quality of life collapse. A widely shared article by columnist Fredrik Virtanen put in the Aftonbladet newspaper says, quote, taxes are the price we pay for civilization. Not only is it cool to pay taxes, it's sexy. the Swedes discovering the damage Republicans can do, what we call Republicans can do to a country. When are we going to figure this stuff out? Well, I think we have. Mitch McConnell is tacking to the left. After all, it's fall. This is the time, you know, of an election year when Republicans all move to the left because we are a center-left country. You got Tom Cotton is running for the Senate from Arkansas as a Republican. He says he would vote to raise the minimum wage, although he would vote for that as a citizen, not as a legislator. Right. Trying to have it both ways. Mitch McConnell has said that he's not ruling out the general concept of a higher minimum wage. Why? Because he's running for re-election. Come on. Cory Gardner in Colorado is saying, hey, yeah, contraceptives, cool. North Carolina's Tom Tillis, same thing. Yeah, contraceptives, let's make them over the counter. Let's make it easy to get. Right. I mean, this is the same thing that Romney did. There's a great article about this in the opinion section of the TPM Cafe, talkingpointsmemo.com. It's incredible. Mike in Arvada, Colorado. Excuse me. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Well, hello, Tom.
How you doing, Mike?
I thought I would pay homage to one of my main gurus here. You guys were talking last week, I believe, about the Jackson State massacre.
Yeah.
I found out early, right after it happened, the only Beach Boys album I ever bought. And it was Cell Block Number 9 Blues, but Jackson State brothers learned not to say nasty things about Southern policemen's mothers. Not to start, there's very little written or available about it because it happened in Jackson State, Mississippi.
Well, thank you for that, Mike. I had put that on my list of things to go track down, and I have not yet done it. So thanks for the reminder. I appreciate it. Well said. Juan in Racine, Wisconsin. Hey, Juan.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I just want to, agree with you that ISIS is an extension of Saudi Arabia. First of all, I'm a Muslim, actually, from Southeast Asia. And, Wahhabi for many Sunnis are not really, Wahhabi actually is not really, it's not a Sunni sect for some Sunnis. Mm-hmm. There are only four Sunni sects, in Islam, which is Shafi, Hanbali, Maliki, and Hanafi. Those are the recognized Muslim sects. Wahhabi Wahhabi is more like a new movement created by somebody in late 1800s or early 1800s.
Yeah.
Now many of these Muslim Sunnis are, I believe, being duped by this Wahhabi terrorist organization, ISIS, Al Qaeda, or you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are terrorist organization, I believe, funded by Saudi Arabia. I don't have the proof, but who else can fund Wahhabi, organization other than Wahhabi itself?
Yeah.
And that's my main thing is, if U.S. want to, bring down all these Wahhabi terrorist organization, they have to rein on Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without the support of Saudi Arabia, I don't think all these Wahhabi-funded organizations can flourish.
Yeah, and we've never had a serious conversation in the United States about our support for Saudi Arabia. I mean, I know it's not going to happen on Fox News because the Saudi prince is the second largest stockholder in Fox News, but the rest of the American media, you would think, would want to have this conversation. Who's with us and who's against us? Apparently, this 28-page Senate report on 9/11 and the consequences of 9/11 points a pretty large finger in the direction of Saudi Arabia, which is one of the reasons why it's being suppressed, or at least that's what I'm reading. I can't say that as a statement of fact. It's just and this being the anniversary of 9/11, let us not forget 17 of those guys flying those planes were directly from Saudi Arabia. And who was it who George Bush flew out of the country right after it happened? The Bin Laden family, people out of Saudi Arabia. So. It's and a lot of people who weren't the Bin Laden family as well. So, Juan, I agree with you. Thank you for sharing that perspective. And I didn't realize the four sects of Sunni Islam. Thank you for that. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, anything goes summer.
There you go.
About the Ray Rice issue where he knocked out his fiancée. Now, domestic violence is an awkward term. Domestic also means men on men. So if we are looking at the National Football League, what about the National Hockey League, where they allow in every game that men can fist fight in every game? Right. So if I bring my 5 or 6 year old son, which I don't have, to a hockey game, and they get to see two dudes going at it with fists, and the National Hockey League allows that to commit assault and battery, what message does that send to our children? Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty bad message, Michael. And but it's not domestic violence. It's just encouraging violence or glorifying violence, and fairly low level violence at that. I mean, typically there's not a lot of animus in these things. They're more theater. But I'm not a fan of the violence that's in hockey or any other sport. It's one of the reasons I like baseball. You know, baseball is a relatively nonviolent sport. It's about skill and strategy. As opposed to, you know, who can pay the most for the biggest, toughest guy, which is basically what has happened with football and increasingly with hockey. And also, you know, when two hockey players are beating each other up, that's not domestic violence. That's gladiators. If you're beating up your 8-year-old kid while you're watching them, that's domestic violence. And, you know, regardless of gender. So, point made. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts, your thoughts, your commentary on it in just a moment. Be sure to check out our new website, by the way, tomhartman.com. We've reinvented it. It looks great.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And our new app, by the way, our Apple app is working great. You may have to reboot it. May have to restart it because we just have a new feed. Welcome back. Robert in Gray Court, South Carolina. You are on the air. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd rather enjoy it. I was just thinking that probably one of the major problems with our economy and so forth and buying politicians is that the ones on the very top are trying to say you can be the world's first trillionaire.
The richest family in America is the Walton family, and I think they're worth about $150 or $180 billion, something like that, the five of them combined. The Koch brothers are worth a little over $80 billion. Bill Gates is worth, what, $40 billion? Warren Buffett's in that neighborhood. A trillion is a long way from that. I mean, that's $1,000 billion. I don't think anybody has...
A trillion is a million.
Yeah, and it's also $1,000 billion.
Yes, $1,000 billion.
Right.
But I do believe that that's a major driving force behind their movement.
That's
be the world's first trillionaire.
That's a mental illness, I'm telling you. That's just absolutely a mental illness. Thanks a lot for the call, Robert. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I'd like to discuss President Obama's speech on ISIS, and also, if I have time, I have an old quote from Walt Lippmann on how the liberal philosophy can help defeat both violence and terrorism.
From Walt Whitman?
No, not Walt Whitman. Daniel did the same thing. Walter Lippmann. I think.
Oh, Walter Lippmann, the journalist,
yes.
And commentator. Yeah,
yes.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, first of all, with respect to President Obama's speech on ISIS, although I agree with an earlier caller, Morris, I think was his name, that the problems in both Iraq and Syria are in large part political and therefore need a political solution, still nonetheless, with respect to Syria, which I was intently listening to the president on last night, I was glad to hear that President Obama seems to have no intentions of working together with the mass-killing, brutal Assad dictatorship, as some people, including Richard Haass, have wrongly and foolishly suggested that President Obama do. Instead, President Obama said that we have ramped up our assistance to the Syrian opposition to Assad. And as President Obama said this past Sunday on Meet the Press, he laid it all out that the reason we're in this situation with ISIS is Assad's brutalization of his own people. And not only do I think that's correct, but just as President Obama has compared ISIS to cancer, I'd compare this dictator Assad to a carcinogen that caused the cancer.
So what would you do about Assad, and how would you prevent his replacement from doing what has happened so often in the Middle East, going after the minority groups in that country? Because Assad has protected the Christians, the Jews, the Alawites. I mean, he's won. He's protected the minority groups.
Well, to an extent, it depends on whether they agree with him or not. If they want a dissent against him, like I said last Friday, he's very totalitarian. He allows no dissent. But what I would do is, I think that reaching out to, and it's not a question of them being the good guys, the people I'm about to mention, but it's a question of them being the better guys than either ISIS or Assad or the al-Nusra Front. I would reach out, as the president has suggested, to the Free Syrian Army, but I would make some demands on them. First of all, I would have them enter into a treaty where they have to agree to to abide by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in addition, I would have them agree to protect minorities, create a democratic society if they replace Assad.
Jerry, I just say good luck with that. This is going to war is taking a wolf by the ears. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Our new book, The American Revolution of 1800, How Jefferson Rescued Democracy from Tyranny and Faction and What This Means Today, by Dan Sisson. By the way, I will be tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. in Seattle speaking at the Yes Magazine gig, yesmagazine.org. You can sign up for it. And Dan Sisson is going to drop by. He'll be there with me. And he's the author. He's a historian, and he's the original author of this book. I wrote a foreword and afterward and helped edit it for the new edition. It's first published 40 years ago. And Dan is a real scholar of this stuff. And here's something interesting. During the era of the founders of our country, the first 30 years or so of the history of the United States, he said, indeed, as we have seen, those who were members of an extreme opposition faction, now think today's modern Republicans, right, were regarded as members of a city within a city, a state within a state, potentially violent revolutionaries. No matter what area of politics one might choose to become active in, administration, the newspaper media, pamphleteering, it was impossible to ignore the fact that the purpose of the government in power was to suppress faction before it could promote civil war and tear the state apart. And then he quotes from a New York Gazette op-ed, it is an axiom in Republican politics that the majority must rule. And in fact, it goes on to say, this power is exercised by proxy, and whoever erects or is necessary in erecting a systematic opposition to this proxy or government established by the people is a bad citizen and merits the resentment of the people. If a party be formed under the auspices of any foreign state to clog the wheels of government, it is treasonably engaged in resisting the will of the people and, of course, deserves capital punishment. This was the theory of the basically one-party state. Whatever party is in charge gets to have its way. It's a fascinating rewrite of American history. You constantly hear Republicans saying, oh, you know, at the founding of our country, you had a split government, you know, and you had the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists and, blah, 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 the Federalists versus the Whigs and versus the Democratic Republicans. Well, no, not so much. During the first three administrations, the Washington, Adams and Jefferson administrations, faction was, you know, the political parties were viewed as a very, very negative force. And if you stood up against the majority, you could be considered a traitor. I mean, it's just a very different time. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, what's up? My question, well, not really a question, but I didn't really get to see the speech last night. Only because, you know, I had things going on that I couldn't control. But from listening to what these Republicans had to say today, it seems that the president took a measured response. He he's also left a way for us to come back from, you know, from whatever military action that we take.
Right.
Instead of leaving any ambiguity that we're supposed to stay there and we're supposed to build up arms and keep this fight going.
Yeah.
Because the reason why I think, you know, we're into this big fight is just the money, period. And I think globalization has a big part to do with it. And as I've said before, I believe there's some route that they're trying to take through the Middle East, whatever is going to be feasible that, you know, we can get goods and, you know, properties flowing easily. And it's going to be at the cost of American lives.
Yeah, I am with you. I think that the president took probably the most measured response that was politically appropriate. And it's a commentary on the sad state of our politics and our media that was it, in my opinion. I'm not pinning this or on the president. I'm not criticizing the president. I do, however, think that this policy is going to come back and bite us in the butt. I think that we're going to have our Gulf of Tonkin moment. Maybe it's just because I lived through the Vietnam era and was traumatized by it, but it seems to me like deja vu all over again, as good old Yogi Berra used to say. Thanks a lot for the call, Charles. Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald.
Hi, Tom. You know, this their situation with what's going on in Iraq, this is so ridiculous. You know, people are up in arms because two American journalists got themselves beheaded. Well, okay, I'm not saying that it was a terrible thing for them to happen to them, but the truth of the matter is we lost 6,000 GIs that were killed in two wars that we shouldn't have even been in, spread by the lies by Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. And no, there was no rage about that.
Yeah.
They seem to be okay. That must be that white privilege you're talking about. And not only that, there too, I'll tell you the truth, and I'm going to start sounding a little harsh. I don't care what happens to these people that are in Iraq and in Syria. You know, you get these crazy leaders that want to kill all their people. Every time you get the media bringing that stuff over here and showing the American people that, it's just another draw to get us into war.
Well, Donald, let me reframe that slightly if I can. I care about them, and I'm guessing, you know, by virtue of common humanity, you care about them. My concern is that when the largely Christian, non-Arab, non-Muslim United States of America starts using, you know, money and force in a Arab and Muslim region of the world, there is no way we can be anything other than the outsider. And as the outsider, we are going to exacerbate the polarization in those areas. And so as a humanitarian, as somebody who is concerned about the people of Syria and Iraq and their fate and future, you know, number one, obviously, I condemn the Bush administration, you know, and their actions that opened the gates of hell to these people. But number two, I think that our non-intervention or our intervention through the proxy of Arab Muslim actors in the region would be much more effective than our inserting ourselves into yet another basically civil war that's going on, you know, civil conflict.
Well, I would feel the same way too, Tom, if our allies were involved, but they never seem to be involved. They always
let's say our Arab allies.
Arab, oh yeah, them too. Boy, they're really
that's my point. This is a regional conflict. It's not an international conflict. It's a regional conflict, and it needs to be dealt with by the actors in the region. Donald, thank you for the call. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you participating. And check out yesmagazine.org if you're in the Seattle area and you want to see me tomorrow night. I'll be there. Be there, be square. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Show up. Make sure you're registered to vote. Find out where you're going to vote. This is a big deal election. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people
who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartmann.com.